Hello, everyone. I'm Frank Riker.
And I'm Darren Sands.
And this is the first ever live recording of the Slaughter Lamb podcast. Darren, how are you doing?
I'm good. This is kind of strange. This is weird. Putting our faces out there for the first time.
We're clothed, fully clothed today.
We are clothed. We usually do it a different way, don't we? But this time we thought we'd put clothes on.
Yeah.
Be seen.
Usually Darren's, you know, in the back facing the wall, still talking, eating something, and I'm in a Chinese basket hanging from the ceiling, you know, but we're still able to do this. But we're gonna try this out for the first time and see how it goes.
Yeah, let's give it a go. I mean, what have we got to lose? You know, people have been asking us to do this for a long time. And
it's like, who gives
a lot of subscribers, maybe?
Do it.
Yeah. Let's just do it. Yeah. People have been asking us to do this for such a long time now, and we've always put it off and gone, no, we don't. Yeah, but I guess let's give it a go, see how it goes. We're going to do a live stream soon, very, very soon as well. And, you know, what better way to kick this off by testing it out first in our bedrooms and you know, see how it goes with a live recording of Cool Cruel Summers.
I know. I do a lot of testing in my bedroom. How about you?
Well, usually I do, but not today. Not today. Certainly, although your bedroom does look quite inviting, Frank, I must admit. A lot of wires hanging there in the background. What's going on?
It's like, you know, with us, I'm not going to turn around. Fuck it. I know what's there. You got your... You got your TV, you got your satellite, you got 16 different maybe DVD, Blu-ray, 4K players that you never decided to take off, and you got a gaming system over there, you got maybe a video recorder, you know, that was hooked up at one point, you just left the fucking wires dangling, and you just really didn't give a shit about cleaning it up.
A lot of action happens in that bedroom, doesn't it? I'm not even allowed a TV in my bedroom. There's nothing. If you ever want to watch something in my bedroom, I have to watch it on my phone.
Oh, my God. You know, but when you're sick and you got the sniffles, you know, with us, we usually got to go to your bedroom and you have the TV on while you're passed out. The TV, I think, is the perfect sleep aid, isn't it? You just have it going on in the background and pass out.
I wouldn't know. I'm not allowed. I'm not allowed one. You know, the bedroom's for sleeping in and that's it.
Well, my bedroom is probably as big as most houses, so you need a decent size. I mean, knowing you, you know, you would probably put a 70 inch in your bedroom and come out looking like Kramer. You know, it'd be right here up to your face.
For those of you who remember when we did the Halloween 3 episode, Frank, you know, collapsed on the floor and the dog was eating out of his beard. It's just there, right to where Frank's
feet. Right down here. Right down there. I have a carpet right here because my floor is hardwood, and I have a carpet. The carpet was the softest spot I could land, and I'm just holding out to my dog like a St. Bernard would find a skier that was underneath some snow in the avalanche, and I'm just holding on to her, and she just, you know, had a full meal of whatever I just drank, and it probably ate that from that lunch that I had, and so you know, she was cleaning me up as I was up chucking all over the place. Yeah, but this is where it happened.
Yeah, so it's the scene of the crime.
Episode 4, 1983. Cool, Cruel Summers. Darren, again, has listed some key moments in history. Darren, you did such a good job. There's actually some very good key moments in human history right here.
I got so much stick last time that I just thought, you know, I've got to be more positive about the years. I think, you know, everything was just full of doom, gloom, death, and God knows what else. but this time I thought, let's pick some kind of uplifting moments as well.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Frank.
We got the first Super Mario, actually the first Mario Brothers game debuts. You know, that's the start of what? The video game, you know, generation.
Evolution.
It's not Pong. You know, it's not fucking E.T. It's actually something you can play. You got the MASH ends after, 11 seasons?
I never saw one episode.
Do you know I didn't even fucking remember. All I remember is that people are saying that the show lasted more than the Korean War. That's the joke.
Right.
The very, very,
Which came
very.
First? Did the film come first, or did
the film came first? I think. Yeah.
And then the TV series, right?
Yep. Okay. Yep. The very beautiful Vanessa Williams becomes the first African American to be crowned Miss America. Oh, she was gorgeous. Very beautiful. And next, I think still till this day, Michael Jackson's Thriller is released. Isn't it still the number one album of all time?
I believe so, yeah. I think it is. Closely followed by, in the US, closely followed by Back in Black by AC/DC.
So, yeah. I think after Michael Jackson died, it actually gave it more of an increase. Because everyone started buying all of his albums up. Fraggle Rock, you know, aired, you know, from my childhood. I never was a Fraggle Rock kid. I was just you know, the Muppets. The Muppets was my thing. But yeah, Fraggle Rock, same company, right? Jim Henson, I believe.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I wasn't sure whether this actually aired in the US because I think it was like a British show. It certainly had the lead guy in it was a Scotsman. And I wasn't sure whether it ever brought. So I was thinking that you might come to me there and say, "What the fuck is Fraggle Rock?"
Oh, I knew a Fraggle Rock was, of course. but now we got to get into some depressing news. Karen Carpenter passed away.
We had to have some.
Yeah, you have to have.
You had to put some depressing news. Yeah.
Karen Carpenter passed away. I think with her eating disorder was mainly the major contributor to it. Slim Pickens actually did ride that bomb all the way down and die. He died in 1983. And David Niven, who was from an old stage. Was he a stage actor before he went to the movies? Because he played James Bond too, didn't he?
In the original Casino Royale, yeah.
During the Academy Awards, didn't some guy run behind him naked and wave? And
yes.
It was like, well, everyone gets to see his shortcomings. That's the only time you ever saw that fucker smile was some nude guy running across the stage. Also, the birth of my brother. He was born in 1983, which I could care less about. Who
that
cares?
Was next on the list. Shall I remove that?
It's glad that it wasn't a key moment for me. So that's it. Well, let's get into why we're really here. Let's get into some movies.
So 1983 was a kind of odd year at the cinema. It wasn't the best year. I mean, it had some big titles, but a lot of them didn't perform as expected, and a lot of them were quite poor entries in franchises. And there were three major franchise pictures that came out in 1983, and all of them were kind of started a downfall of those franchises.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much the first one we're going to talk about. So the first movie that came out was May 25, 1983. The third movie in the Star Wars trilogy was Episode 6, Return of the Jedi.
Return of the Jedi. From the desert fortress of Jabba the Hutt. Jedi. To the Death Star of the Galactic Empire. To the forest city of the Ewoks. This is the climactic chapter in the Star Wars saga. Remember the Force. Rejoice in the triumph. Return of the Jedi. Rated PG. Now playing at a theater in your galaxy.
Frank, your thoughts, Return of the Jedi?
Well, I actually like Return of the Jedi. I think you and I both agree that Empire Strikes Back is the top of the original trilogy. Then it becomes, you know, Return of the Jedi, which was supposed to be revenge. But I think Wrath of Khan took that away. I think they switched it up maybe because of that. But it was, I liked it. I liked the original version. I don't like the anniversary editions afterwards where Hayden Christensen is taken out. I mean, he's put in, stand in, you know, for Anakin. I don't like that because you don't put a young, everyone's old. Oda's fucking old. Obi-Wan's old. And here you go. You got this young guy who's taking care of these geriatrics, you know, as a caretaker. And, you know, making sure, you know, Obi-Wan, you know, doesn't dribble, you know, his fucking blue milk. And Yoda knows where the fuck he's going because you put Yoda somewhere, he'll bump into a wall. You have to pick him up and turn him around. Maybe that's why they put him a young Anakin in there. But this is actually the first time I think we see the Emperor. Isn't it? Because other ways we saw him as a hologram.
He was shown as a hologram, I think, in The Empire Strikes Back, wasn't he? What's interesting about this is that they were really struggling with the title for it for a while. It was initially going to be called Revenge of the Jedi. And in fact, if you can get some merchandise with Revenge of the Jedi written on it, then it's going to be worth some money. One of your old friends, Pat Welsh, who was the voice of E.T., was also a voice of one of the characters in this film.
Ladies and gentlemen,
she's a woman, Frank.
Smoke two packs a day, and you'll become the voice of some creature.
Yeah, there was no guarantee that Harrison Ford was going to be in Return of the Jedi because he was on a picture-to-picture deal. He wasn't on, like, he hadn't been signed up for the trilogy like Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher had. And so at the end of Empire Strikes Back, because they were unsure as to whether he was going to be around for the third film, that's why they stuck him in the carbonite. Because that way they could do whatever they wanted then. If he came back, they can defrost him. If he didn't come back, he could still stay in that bloody lump of ice.
It's an iconic shot, right? Now,
you know, that's terrific.
Now people are superimposing their own faces on that. And, you know, it must be I remember they did a Family Guy episode where Peter was playing as Han. But, you know, before he went to the carbonite, he mooned everybody. So all you'd see was his frozen ass. And then as he was getting, you know, thawed out, you know, he had the longest flatulent because he was holding it in for so long. He's like, sorry. Oh, so sorry. Oh. It's kind of built up there. It's a long time. Sorry.
I do remember that. Wasn't it kind of slowly seeping out as he was thawing?
Yeah. it was great. But also, this is probably the first time every geek started, you know, probably whacking off to Princess Leia in her slave outfit.
Well, she did a few decent shots, didn't she, of that?
But you had
the publicity
to,
shots of her on the beach and all that kind of stuff, which were totally uncalled for. But
and a lot of women do it now. They have a lot of, you know, they have outfits that people can dress up as Princess Leia now for Halloween or just...
All these cosplay things.
Oh, yeah. So a few famous people, like Olivia Munn has dressed up as Princess Leia, and I don't think Carrie Fisher ever did it since. but, you know, it was certainly an iconic a moment, too, because they said they wanted people to make sure that she was a woman by dressing her in scandalous outfits.
Have you ever done cosplay, Frank?
I actually have her outfit. I do dress up like that now and then.
So back to the film. What do you? How have you found the changes that they've made to it over the years?
I hate them. Yeah, I hate them, especially you know, where they're in Jabba's palace and they ripped apart the dance sequence.
Yeah,
you know, and they had this, you know, this alien started dancing and singing around and everyone's just like bopping to it. You know, you don't need to add that shit. They made it more kiddie.
Yeah. And the Sarlacc was terrible as well. The Sarlacc was kind of, I guess, less vaginal, but kind of looked more like...
secretions.
Yeah, it looked more like Audrey 2 from Little Shop of Horrors coming out of there.
Fucking Audrey. and Boba Fett was Rick Moranis, you know, in this one, in the 30th edition. Jeez, yeah, I mean, but that was his, but I guess George, when they put the trilogy back out with all these, you know, with all these extra features and everything, it still became number one back at the box office, including Return of the Jedi. And you can't, I mean, we can go on and on about Return of the Jedi, but there's some people out there that know way more than you and I would ever.
This isn't a deep dive into it, you know. I mean, I love Star Wars as a kid, and I think those first three movies that we got, episodes 4, 5, and 6, were are the best. You know, Jedi is the worst of those. I mean, it's not bad, but to me, it's like such an obvious attempt to market toys. Like, there's so many toy opportunities in that movie that it's embarrassing. Everything that walks on the screen and... You know, and the reason why, because originally the whole thing of the Ewoks, it was meant to be Wookiees on Chewbacca's planet, because, you know, you couldn't sell any more Chewbacca dolls. They created these Ewoks that, just watching them now, it's just a bit embarrassing, isn't it? Having said that, there are some absolute you know, some of the best moments of the franchise in this movie as well, particularly the final battle between Luke and Vader with the Emperor. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that moody lightsaber sequence, which is just superb, and the score that John Williams did with that, you know, kind of really moody, and there's that kind of sort of choir that's in the background as well, giving it sort of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. I know what you're saying. Yeah.
You know what I mean. It's a great moment, but with a budget of $32 million, it was quite an expensive film back in 1983.
I think the most expensive million. One, right? Wasn't it? It was because they just kept increasing the budgets.
With a budget of $32 million and a box office of $477 million, Rotten Tomato score 82%. I'd say someone was pretty cool to Return of the Jedi.
Yeah. Yeah, and it gave us, you know, a whole bunch of Ewok dolls. Gave us an Ewok spin. You know, was it the Ewok Christmas special? I think a short-lived series. You know, and I think
two Ewok spin-off movies.
And I had an Ewok doll, and all I remember is just things like losing fucking hair constantly all over the place, and my dad saying, "What do we have, a fucking cat?" You know, it's and it was creepy too. It was like a Furby. But yeah, but this is the one that actually, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Return of the Jedi was the one who made all these.
It was certainly a huge push to sell toys. But anyway, just 1 week later than Return of the Jedi, a really famous horror character returned to the screens who hadn't been around since 1960, Anthony Perkins in Psycho 2.
It's 22 years later. Norman Bates is coming home. Psycho 2.
It's starting again.
Rated R. Starts Friday at a theater near you.
Frank, you're a resident expert on Psycho 2.
I love Psycho 2. I absolutely love it. I think, besides Halloween 4, I think it's the best comeback of a slasher of all time. You can't do this movie without Anthony Perkins. You can't do this movie without... fuckers. You can't do this without Anthony Perkins. But because he originally said no, but they got him to do it. They were actually going to have Christopher Walken come in. Could you? I talked about this with Dave and Tony when they did the two dudes and some bullshit. Could you imagine Christopher Walken as Norman? Mommy, you know, like, I can't deal with Walken voice. But it doesn't work without Perkins, does it? You have to have him.
No. Well, the original plan was to make it a TV movie because they never thought they'd get him to come back. So I think it was going to be an unknown person or whoever as a TV movie. And then all of a sudden he signed on and that was it. It was a theatrical release.
Yeah. Yeah. And they had Meg Tilly in there, but they were going to put, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis, and everyone's just like, ugh.
Yeah.
She didn't want to do it because she didn't want to be known as somebody who would follow in her mother's footsteps, even though she established herself as a screen queen. But they got Meg Tilly, and Meg Tilly, you know, the sister of Jennifer Tilly, she didn't grow up with the TV and didn't know who Anthony Perkins was. And Tony took a little, you know, took offense to that. And they were just like, well, I'm kind of, he didn't say it, but everyone knew he was kind of a big deal. And there was kind of like no respect between each other. But they made it work on screen.
Yeah, I've been reading about that. There was a lot of conflict between the two of them, wasn't there? And to the point where they just didn't engage with each other outside of their takes.
Yeah, no. It was just she didn't like the setting. However, Richard Franklin, the director, made her feel at home. You know, Tom Holland, you know, the writer who actually became famous for Fright Night, a great vampire movie, made her feel, saying like, you're doing a good job, don't worry about it. Anthony wanted to start the production again after they filmed 50% of it and switch her out. I mean, how much would that cost a studio to refilm 50% of something that's already been recorded? I mean, would that be a lot of money, wouldn't it?
I would have thought so. I mean, it's not like today, whereas, you know, like the recent Army of the Dead movie had one of the characters was cancelled during post-production because of some, you know, accusations against him, and they were digitally removed, and a new actress was replaced that person. Mm-hmm. And she never interacted with anybody on that production at all, any of the cast on that production. But when you watch that movie, Army of the Dead, which I quite liked, by the way, it's seamless. You can't tell that she's been digitally added afterwards. One of the parts of this movie that always kind of gets me, and the movie's a slow burn. It's good. You know, I really do like it. But one of the parts that always gets me is that the bit at the end where Norman hits the lady over the head with a shovel.
Mrs. Spool?
Yeah. That is just... How'd they do that? Because it's kind of one take, isn't it?
Foam shovel.
It was a foam shovel, was it? Right? But it looked incredible.
And the stunt lady with... You see, all of a sudden when he hits her in the head with a shovel, her hair poofs out. Yeah. There's actually a protector in the back, you know, of that head.
Right.
But you hear that ding as soon as you hear
it. Yeah, yeah. And she's on the floor shaking away, you know. It was just, it's horrific, is that sequence.
But there's a guy on YouTube who has that looping for 10 minutes.
What, just being hit over the head?
Just ding, ding.
For 10 minutes. Is that all? 10 minutes.
He can always go back and watch it for another 10. But then after a while, if you watch it, I think I told the guy, I said, you have to make it a try not to laugh, and you have to watch the whole thing. And after I watched it, and I think after maybe about 2 minutes, I started cracking up. Yeah. Because it's just, okay, I get it.
It's... you know, the movie's good, and, you know, there was another two sequels that came after this. I don't think either of them sort of lived up to, you know, how good this movie was. Directed by Richard Franklin, who did, you know, you mentioned, you know, he did Blue Lagoon and Road Games with Jamie Lee Curtis and Stacey Keach. Anthony Perkins, Vera Miles, Meg Tilly, Robert Legere, and Dennis France. Dennis France, of course... You know, actor that's kind of cut from the same cloth as Burt Young. went to the Burt Young Charm School.
but not a Golden Globe winner.
Oh, there's something about Dennis France that just really kind of, I don't know, I just find him slightly unwatchable, that's all. But
what do you mean, like sleazy, like in Blowout?
Especially Die Hard 2 and things like that. You're just annoying all the time. but I know he's a good actor. Yeah, so Psycho 2, released on June the 3rd of 1983. $12 million budget for a return of... a $5 million budget for a return of $34.7 million. Rotten Tomatoes score of 60%. Yes, it was cool. You know, it was not a bad, for something that, and you're talking nearly 40 years ago now, $34.7 million 40 years ago was a lot of money. So I reckon the summer was cool to this film, and it's certainly got its fans.
I agree. It's now a culture icon. Everyone who watches this movie now is kind of like, how did I not discover this, you know, back, you know, 40 years ago? Well, maybe because you were only fucking five. First of all, but also there are some people that think Psycho 2 and the rest and 3 and 4, 4 is New Beginning. I don't like movies where in the middle of a fucking franchise or series, you're like a new beginning. Well, what happened to the last fucking movie? But I think the reason why it went to 60% and wasn't even higher to maybe, I would say it should be around the 80% mark, is because you don't fuck with Alfred Hitchcock's masterpieces. You don't make a sequel out of Psycho. You don't do a sequel to Rear Window. You know, you shouldn't make a sequel to North by Northwest. You know, any of that stuff. I think a lot of people even Vera Miles says, I don't want to be doing this. You know, fuck it. that's why I think there's 60. But it's in my collection, and I proudly watch it whenever I get the hankering.
And on the same day, June the 3rd, War Games was released.
It's big hit. This time it's War Games, and it's brilliant, says Joel Siegel of ABC TV. Roger Ebert calls it wonderful and gives it 4 stars. A high-powered thriller, says Newsweek magazine. And People magazine proclaims it as good as last summer's E.T. Don't miss the most exciting game on any screen. War Games, rated PG.
Now playing at the Capitol, UA Sunrise, Sacramento Drive-In, and Sherwood in Stockton.
I love that. I love that. Now playing at the AMC Clearview Theater. It probably doesn't fucking exist anymore, you know, wherever these places are.
What I like about that is, as well, as good as last summer's E.T. Oh,
fuck it, man. Are you fucking kidding me? Last summer's E.T. Are you... I mean, it's not released by the same company, right? It wasn't released by...
No, but it's kind of a sexy quote to put on your campaign, isn't it, I guess? But, you know, E.T. stood the test of time. I watched this yesterday, and it's kind of... There are certain things that happen in this film that drew attention to hacking and things like that. The term firewall had never been used in a movie before. No one knew what it was, but in this... You know, they talk about firewalls, and nowadays it's one of those things that people have for their own security. But security was pretty lax in this film. You know, the fact that Matthew Broderick can use a computer that can hack into the U.S. defense system, which, by the way, is called Whopper. Matthew Broderick taking on Whopper. The fact that he can hack into this defense system by figuring out what the password is, which is it pencil or something like that? It's something really stupid and ridiculous. It's a fun film. It doesn't take itself too seriously, but it's just like, why is he arsing around on computers being all nerdy and geeky when he's got Ali Sheedy sat in his bedroom? You know, I'd be doing something else, wouldn't you?
It could add another tagline in there: more lasers than Han's pistol. It's like, okay, we got E.T. and Star Wars in there now, you know. But yeah, you're right. I mean, she's sitting there, she's getting all hot and bothered, but maybe he thinks that she won't be turned on unless he starts a nuclear war. Look at this.
He just spends his time ignoring her.
I'm gonna fire a missile at Russia. Will that make you all moist? Matthew Broderick didn't learn how to type. He had to learn how to type in this fucking movie.
It all starts innocently, and it's quite fun the way it starts, with him kind of hacking the computer at school and changing his grades and all that kind of thing. But it quickly escalates to him being able to hack into the heart of the war operation plan response system. It's fine, I think. Back then, when it came out, people were kind of like in awe of it because it was so technologically advanced and nothing had ever come out like this before. But when you look at it now, it's like, Jesus Christ, it's no wonder he could fucking hack into this system. You could lean on that computer and hack into it by accident. You know what I mean? It was
just... You pour a cup of water on the keyboard, you are in.
Yeah, exactly. You know? It was, oh, shit, you're in.
There's no cloud, right? There's no cloud at this time. You know, there was only two satellites, you know, whatever the U.S. put up in Sputnik. You know, that was the only thing that's... Sputnik's probably still floating around there somewhere. I think it actually came back. But anyway, I could tell you who was really impressed by this movie was President Reagan. As he based his whole he based his whole Star Wars, you know, missile defense on it. You know, it's like, really? Yeah. Ronnie, are you sure you want to do this? Make sure the password
to... Impact.
An impact. He probably put the same password as pencil. You know, just it's, could you imagine? But it is dated, you know, like you said, it is. I mean, I think the kids today, if they watch War Games, they're going to be like, oh, look at the technology. What did you guys do back then? Oh, my God, isn't it horrible? I mean, you have to type? You couldn't just do speech to text?
So directed by John Badham, who did Saturday Night Fever, Short Circuit, and Stakeout as well, if I remember rightly. Matthew Broderick, Dabney Coleman, flipping heck. Is he dead now?
No, he's still alive. Still alive.
Is he still alive? Ali Sheedy, who I just think looks terrific in this film.
Not Spencer, Matthew.
No, exactly, yeah. John Spencer, who, you know, really didn't kind of establish himself until later on in life when he was in, I think it was he in The West Wing and The Rock? You know, mm-hmm. He was great in that film. And also a really young Michael Madsen who opens up the movie. It's fine. It's okay. I just think it's of its time, and I think I was more kind of wowed by it when it first came out rather than I am now. But interestingly enough, Martin Brest was the original director and was mm-hmm. fired a couple of weeks into shooting. But, you know, he kind of had the last laugh because he went on to direct Beverly Hills Cop straight after this. So
it actually made more money too, Beverly Hills Cop.
It did. Absolutely did. I mean, this was a cool movie. 93% on Rotten Tomatoes, $12 million budget, and a $79.5 million box office. So, you know, again, another hit. We were a bit, you know, I think we were hard up for movies in 1983. We've kind of picked out the best, and I'm honestly, the best aren't really anything, you know, like 1982's year or 1984 that's coming up.
Yes, correct.
But on what date would it be now? June 8th, what I think is a classic came out, and this
comedy
is John
classic.
Landis's
comedy classic.
John Landis's Trading Places.
How you doing?
Eddie Murphy, the funniest man in America.
Once you have a man with no legs, you never go back, baby.
In Trading Places, the funniest comedy of the summer.
I have legs.
Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy in Trading Places. Some very funny business.
Freeze, slime ball.
Moi.
Trading Places. Rated R.
Starts Wednesday at a theater near you.
Darren, you can't do a movie like this anymore, can you?
You can't. That's the
damn
thing.
Damn it.
Fuck you. It's a shame. It really is. You know, because I don't know this hasn't been on TV in the UK for a long time. And there are a lot of moments in this film which kind of make you sort of cringe nowadays. The movie was of its time and things were different back in the 80s. But you can't, it's like watching Blazing Saddles or Airplane. Within all those movies, there are moments that are of their time and you know, jokes that are made that don't necessarily wash today. And Trading Places is one of them. And you know, Don Ameche, who was obsessed with his faith and things like that, it made him uncomfortable swearing in that film. And there's a bit towards the end of the movie where he's with his brother, played by Ralph Bellamy, and his brother's kind of having a heart attack because they're slowly losing all their money. And, you know, somebody's pointing out to him, you know, your brother. And he turns around and goes, fuck him. Now, he would only do that once because of he didn't want to use bad language. However, he's quite free and easy with the N-word throughout the movie, isn't he?
He is.
But, you know, having said that, it's a damn funny movie. I laughed at it then and I still laugh at it now. However, I do feel slightly uncomfortable for people that haven't seen it and are watching it for the first time, because it probably can be quite shocking.
You know what? But it's a lot of those jokes back then, and Eddie Murphy has said this. Yes, they are of their time. However, when you take those jokes and people laugh at them, it kind of loses the reason why those words and those scenarios are there. It makes it comfortable for people to talk about them instead of putting them in the corner and hiding them and just being, you know, disgusted by them. And this movie that wasn't supposed to have Dan Aykroyd. It was Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor. Two of the best comedic, I want to say best friends, because they loved each other, Richard and Gene. But unfortunately, Richard Pryor tried to fucking blow himself up and kill himself.
Yeah, he was injured. I didn't know exactly what he did, but he was injured at the time, wasn't he? And so that's why they turned to Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy. But they were really concerned about casting Dan Aykroyd because he usually was kind of part of a double act, wasn't he? He was, you know, him and Jim Belushi John Belushi.
Yep.
John Belushi were
Sly Stallone.
Yeah, yeah.
Jesus Christ.
They were in Blues Brothers together, and also, you know, they were famous for pairing up on Saturday Night Live all the time, and so they were a bit worried about casting Dan Aykroyd, but it certainly worked. You know, the box office wise, we're looking at, yeah, $90 million for a $15 million budget, and 88% on Rotten Tomatoes. So the critics at the time loved it. It's a smart comedy.
And a couple Golden Globes came out from that movie.
Yeah.
Lee Curtis, who people didn't want in this movie.
I was going to say a couple of Globes. Jamie Lee Curtis.
Her first Golden Globes on screen, but the award, the Golden Globe. You know, the Golden Globe, you know, she won. And so did Elliot, right? He won the Golden Globe. John Landis, you know, when he cast this movie, he didn't know who the hell Eddie Murphy was. Just like, hey, who the hell's Michael Jackson? You mean little Michael? Jackson 5, Michael? But, you know, it certainly had a lot of careers. You know, it spawned a lot of friendships after this. You know, Murphy and Landis went on to do other films together. Same thing with Aykroyd and Curtis. You know, they went on to do My Girl, if I'm not mistaken.
They did. That's right. Yeah.
And it's and would you consider this a Christmas movie? Let's get to that, just because it is during the Christmas season. It is in Italy. Italy has it playing during every Christmas season.
I think if it's a Christmas setting and it makes you feel Christmassy and you know you're watching it in December, then why not? If you want it to be a Christmas movie, then good luck to you. The movie works without it being at Christmas, but. You know, some people like to think of it as a Christmas film, which I'm kind of cool with.
What is your favorite part? Because I will tell you mine.
My favorite part is, I've actually written this down, it's a part of the movie which actually really creeps me out as well, which is when Dan Aykroyd's windfall.
It's mine too. Rock
bottom. And he's sitting on the tube. It's pissing down with rain. He's sat on the tube. And he pulls out that big piece of salmon and he starts to eat it through the dirty Santa beard. And he's pulling
it's,
it and all this.
It's like this,
dirty,
right?
Gray hair. Yeah. It's like and even the salmon's filthy as well. That's my favorite part. Always has been my favorite part of that movie. But
and no one notices him. He's a dirty, bum Santa Claus. And then when Eddie, who plays Valentine, comes down and he. He goes, Winthorpe!
He does just growl at him, doesn't he?
He's like, fuck you, kind of thing. But yeah, I don't own this. I don't know why. Maybe because they play it all the time where I am on cable. But they do edit some parts out, which does do a disservice. I mean, our friend, you know, Dave McRae would always say, you're taking parts out of movies, which is taking parts out of history. Could you imagine, you know, if they just chopped up Airplane? You know, they took out the boobs, which you really don't need the boobs jiggling, you know, that one scene. They just threw it in there.
You do. Yeah.
But imagine if they took out, you know, Captain Over talking to, I think his name is Billy. Imagine if they took that out.
Yeah.
It's
should
sort
just
of,
leave but, these things, you know.
So... We're moving. We're going to be moving from, you know, JB's Golden Globes, you know, to Pussy. And that's Octopussy. You know, Chase Bond's Octopussy.
Here we go.
For the first time on network television, the one that surpasses them all.
Am I to be your target for tonight?
Step on it.
Roger Moore is James Bond in Octopussy.
Sunday.
That's all I could find. There's not much out there in the way of short trailers for Octopussy, but that's it.
Well, doesn't Octo
this film's
he had his hands
there was
full,
a lot of people were really embarrassed. Yeah, a lot of people were really embarrassed about the fact that the title was Octopussy, and when they were interviewed and asked what it was called, a lot of the cast, they were all like, I'm keeping the title secret. They just couldn't handle, you know, explaining what it was. I used to like this Bond film for years. I used to really enjoy it. It had some really bizarre moments in it, and it kind of sort of capitalizes on that sort of Raiders of the Lost Ark
type action,
you know, bandwagon, if you like. Yeah. But some of the action's just awful in it.
Like on top of the airplane? Just dangling right there?
Yeah, with the aerial. But interestingly, again, just like there's three films that we're going to talk about today that initially had different people cast in lead roles to begin with. And with this one, James Brolin was originally going to play Bond because I think Roger Moore had got to the end and was like, that's it, he didn't want to do anymore. And it's actually, you can see online screen tests of James Brolin with the cast and different members of the cast acting out certain scenes from Octopussy. But he's got an American accent. Now, whether the plan was to kind of change that to when he was actually filming, he was going to do it as a British accent, I have no idea. But it was kind of odd. And while they were sort of in pre-production, word got out that Never Say Never was going to be filmed by Warner Brothers, which is the kind of rogue Bond movie, the kind of unofficial Bond movie that Sean Connery got involved with. And they kind of had no option but to bring back Roger Moore and, you know, to be able to compete with him. So I think they offered Roger Moore some big bucks to sort of come back and, you know, and do his bit.
I know that I think that Bond movies should be British. You can't have anyone. They should be in there with a British actor. It's not Roger Moore's best. I actually hold this below, you know, A View to a Kill. I actually think View to a Kill is actually better. Does the UK? I think I asked you this before a long time ago. Do they hold the character of James Bond in high regard? Do they protect that character? The main character will always be a. Yeah, I mean, the main character will always be prey. I mean, there's that whole thing we discussed a couple streams ago. Should have Mel Gibson ever played 007?
Oh.
Like you said, he's about bow-legged.
5'4". Yeah, bow-legged and 5'4". No. There are plenty of guys out there who could play Bond.
Elba. Everyone's always putting that rumor out there.
Yeah,
that,
why not?
He's British, right? He can handle it. Yeah. I think it's because
I think he's too old, though. I mean, that's the whole thing, you know.
Mate's almost he's like in his 50s now, isn't he?
Yeah. And but when, you know, the Daniel Craig became Bond, he was in his sort of mid to late 30s. And you got to think that, you know, you got to have at least four or five movies in them. So probably Idris Elba's a little bit, you know, late to the party, I think, but.
I mean, who could see what? Who do you think? Tom Hardy?
Maybe.
He's too bulky, I think. He's too. he's gonna put on that Bane mask, you know. 007.
He wears a mask in every film he's in.
He does. You are absolutely right.
He wore a mask in Mad Max. He wore a mask in Dunkirk all the time. He was talking like that. Bane. It's just never ending the amount of masks that guy has to wear.
Yeah, however, I know we're getting on a tangent, but his best movie today, I still think, is Bronson.
Good film. Have you seen Legend?
Yes.
Yeah. Another good film.
But okay, we gotta beat this pussy off. And did you go over the budget?
Yeah, Octopussy was a $27.5 million budget. And made $68 million. Made $68 million in the US. So 42% on Rotten Tomatoes. The critics weren't that keen on Octopussy. But, you know, while Octopussy was shooting, in the next soundstage next door, another movie was shooting. And that was Superman 3.
Alexander Salkind presents Christopher Reeve and Richard Pryor.
Watch the trees.
As you've never seen them before. With more action. More twists.
You're going to go down in history as the man who killed Superman.
No. And more fun.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Than Superman has ever had before. Superman 3, rated PG. Starts Friday, June 17th. Please check newspapers for...
Did they just dubbed Robert Vaughn's voice?
Maybe. What, in that TV spot?
Yeah.
It could have been.
It's just... Robert has this very distinct voice. He has this very, you know, almost blue-collar but wealthy-type voice. I remember watching Superman 3, and he was the guy was just like, so, Bert Goodbye, you'll be gone as the man who killed Superman. This guy was just like, you'll be going down as the man who killed Superman.
It could have been a different take.
Is this your second least favorite Superman movie?
You know what? As a kid, I was invited to the cinema by a friend and his mum. And I had a choice. Two films had come out pretty much around the same time, which was Superman 3 and Return of the Jedi. And I was loyal to Christopher Reeve and the Superman franchise. And I chose Superman 3 over Return of the Jedi, which I kind of...
understand completely.
Yeah, I kind of regret not seeing Return of the Jedi in the cinemas. I ended up seeing it on video for the first time. But Superman 3 at the time, as a kid, I found it really funny. Now I just find it a little bit embarrassing. You know, Richard Lester, the director who'd kind of finished off Superman 2, directed this film. Christopher Reeve, Annette O'Toole, Annie Ross, Robert Vaughn, Richard Pryor, and Pamela Stevenson. A really odd cast. Richard Pryor kind of did it for the money, and yeah. It just doesn't it's a complete diversion to what the other two movies were. I mean, the other two were kind of really unique and some of the best superhero movies ever made. Whereas this, it starts off like, well, I mean, it's almost like you've got two or three people from Benny Hill in the opening of it for starters.
You actually do. Henry McGee is in it, right?
Bob Todd's in there as well. You know, there's this kind of whole slapstick sequence of people kind of falling over in the street and, you know, and then a car crashes and the water hydrant bursts into the underneath the car and fills the car up. There are some interesting super feats in this, but...
don't forget about the exploding penguins.
Yeah, the penguins on fire, yeah. But I think you and I agree that one of the most fascinating and sort of disturbing parts of Superman 3 is Annie Ross's, who plays Vera, her transformation into the robot towards the end.
It's fucking terrifying as a
kid. It's absolutely terrifying.
Things, you know, going like this to your fucking face, you know, and screaming, then all of a sudden, you know, you come out as, you know, something that can shoot, you know, lasers from your fingertips and levitate people in the sky. I think this is the first time we see, you know, Superman bone somebody as well.
Yeah, he does. He gets pissed and laid.
he loses his virginity.
He does. It's a really odd film. The original title for this film was Superman v Superman, because obviously there's that bit midway through where he gets sort of, he's under the influence from the kryptonite and this evil side.
Which has tar in it. Because there was a material that they couldn't, that Richard Pryor can't figure out what is, because Richard Pryor in here is a computer genius, not even knowing he's a computer genius. He's just like, I put stuff in and it comes up. He finds the formula for kryptonite, but then he adds fucking tar from his cigarettes. You would think, you know, it would have some sort of effect, which they find out that makes him evil. Turns him bad. Who knew?
Yeah. And that's a great old sequence as well. That fight sequence is good. It's edgy. It's tough. It's well shot as well. You know, there's not any bits where you're going, hang on a minute, that's a double there, or, you know, it's just doesn't look right. It's shot really, really smartly so that it convinces you that these guys are really, the same person is really fighting himself. Again, like we said with Bond, Christopher Reeve wasn't initially going to be on board with this because he hated the script so much. It took a lot of convincing. He said, I'm not going to do this unless you totally change the script. And initially there was some mad plot that revolved around Brainiac and a few other villains that was completely tonally different to any of the other Superman films that had come before. And so they started to move forward with that with Tony Danza as Superman.
Taxis Tony Danza. Who's the boss? Yeah. Tony Danza.
And I just think that would have been suicide, really, wouldn't it? They could have Superman.
They could have kept Brainiac, because Brainiac is a Superman major villain. But what I from also I understand they were actually going to have Supergirl in here, but there was going to be a part where he didn't know that Supergirl was his cousin, and there was actually going to be a moment where they, let's just say they passionately kiss each other.
Yeah, yeah.
And just like everyone's like, oh, okay, let's just forget about it. They were actually going to have their, as some people say, their Leia and Luke moment, which today people are just like, oh. But still, you know, there was no relation to the actual physical people on screen, but it's just the imagery, you know, that you guys are kissing cousins.
Yeah.
But I don't mind this movie. I like Richard Pryor in it. You know, he's got this.
And he got laid as well, apparently.
Where did he get his?
He had an affair with Margot Kidder.
No, are you serious?
He did. It came out later, years later, I think, when with his biography, him and Margot Kidder were at it. And she's barely in the film. She's kind of bookends the movie, and I think there's a lot of that was to do with the fact that her and I don't think her and Richard Lester got on too well. So
yeah, and Hackman. Kind of, this is the first one where Lex Luthor wasn't in it at all.
Yeah, yeah. And also, it's the first one without Superman's real hair. He's wearing a toupe.
The little curl.
He wore a wig. I never knew this. I when you look, you kind of think, yeah, I guess so. But apparently, Christopher Reeve's hair had got to the point where it was kind of going a bit thin at this stage. And so, you know, he wore a wig for Superman 3. Whether he did for 4 or not, I don't know. But 3, certainly.
Did you mind Annette O'Toole being in it?
No, I like Annette O'Toole. She was good, a good Lana Lang. And I like the whole thing with her in Smallville as well. She's a good actress.
Yeah, there's an Easter egg where you remember when there was a kid at the photo booth.
Yeah,
and he takes a Superman comes out. It's you could see the different photos of him changing into the outfit.
Yeah,
and that's when he rips it. It gives him the photo, and because he doesn't want the kid to know his identity. Well, the kid already knows his identity because that's the older version of Kal-El from the first Superman,
from the original.
Yeah, he's the naked little boy that was, you know, a few years older, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
So basically, it's Superman meeting Superboy. So they brought him back, you know, and kind of like a nice little, you know, tip of the hat or you know, meeting oneself, but. The critics didn't like this, did they? 30%.
No, that's not tomatoes. A good score, is it?
Not a good opening either.
No, I mean, it was a huge budget, $39 million back in 83. That's more than Return of the Jedi. And, you know, the biggest budget of all the films. Actually, no, not the biggest budget of all the films we're going to talk about. There is one more that's an honorable
up to this point, though.
Up to this point, it's certainly the biggest budget. And came in at $59.5 million. So, you know, really only earned $20 million. Given the history of the franchise and the money it's brought in the past, I know it made a profit, but I'm going to say the summer was cruel to it because this was the end of the beginning of the end for the Superman franchise in the 80s, unfortunately.
Yeah, and certainly the one we'll talk about towards the later 80s. That's the nail in the coffin at that point. But we're putting Superman in the coffin at this point. We're not shutting it. You know, we're slowly letting him in it. Unfortunately, with the next movie we're talking about, there was a real coffin made for that actor that actually was on screen.
There were three.
Yeah, unfortunately. But we have to talk about it. June 24th's Twilight Zone, the movie.
Did you ever watch the Twilight Zone? Boy, they were scary. They were great. I loved it.
You want to see something really scary?
Yeah. Okay, pull the car over.
Pull the car over?
Okay.
Scare me.
What are you doing?
Twilight Zone, the movie. Rated PG.
Yeah. Sad times. Unfortunately, this movie... Whatever you think about the movie itself, you can't talk about this movie really without this cloud that hangs over it of the death of Vic Morrow and the two kids in the section that kicks off the film. The section in question is directed by John Landis, and it was called Time Out. Mm-hmm. It's kind of about this guy who's a bit of a bigot. He's sort of propelled to he's a racist, he's a sexist, he's misogynistic. guy, and he's sort of propelled to different key moments in history in order for these moments to kind of teach him a lesson. And it's kind of moments in history like World War II. There's a bit where he's kind of hunted by Klansmen. And there's a sequence where he's attacked during the Vietnam War. And it's during that sequence where he's kind of rescuing two, I guess, Vietnamese children. And he's running across a... It's kind of like some marshland or a little...
Yeah,
a
swampy kind of area, something like that. Yeah,
swampy area, yeah. And something went wrong with a helicopter above, which kind of got tangled up in some rigging or something. And the helicopter crashed down on top of the three of them, Vic Morrow holding the two kids. Vic Morrow, who's Jennifer Jason Leigh's dad. Mm-hmm. And they were all killed instantly. And this, you know, was on film. It's just horrible, and you know, unfortunately, I mean, there's a documentary on Amazon at the moment called "Cursed Movies," and it's kind of a half an hour documentary on this incident, and they do show you it as well, which is pretty tough to see. You know, it's not particularly graphic because it happens so quickly; it's just over in a split second. But it is just a horrible tragedy that, you know. I think if this happened today, then the film wouldn't have been released. But, you know, the film was released. The movie's not that great anyway. There are four stories within the movie itself.
That's not original. These stories are all just redone old Rod Serling movie shows, you know. And it's, you know, they got the Gremlin on the plane, you know, was it Terror at 10,000 Feet, you know, or something like that. Which John Lithgow does a great performance on it. It was absolutely awesome on it. You know,
playing Shatner's role, wasn't he?
Playing Shatner.
William Shatner was in the original.
This actual movie started John Landis and Steven Spielberg not being friends anymore. Mm. He cut all ties. And it's sad, too, because Spielberg's first directorial role was from a Rod Serling show called Night Gallery, and where he got to direct a Hollywood royalty, Joan Crawford, you know, playing a blind woman who gets sight for the first time but kills herself accidentally because she thought she was blind still, but it was actually a New York City blackout, you know, with Burgess Meredith, you know, narrating it, you know, who was also a Twilight Zone alum. Nancy Cartwright, an actress in it, who is the sister of the kid who wishes for things and they actually come true. She goes on to become the voice of Bart Simpson and making millions, you know, hand over fist. Like you said, this movie just has the stigmata of what happened, of John Landis telling this helicopter, go down lower, lower, lower. And the set director who, you know, built this beautiful set, you know, and someone coming up to him and say, what does it feel like hitting the big times before the tragedy happened? And knowing that everything he set up could have been the cause of this accident. Basically everyone except for the actors and mostly the directors kind of lost their, I guess, their jobs, and no one would ever hire them because of that.
Yeah, it kind of went on for quite a few years afterwards as well. There was, you know, there were a lot of court cases and things like that, and Landis was up for manslaughter, and five of them up that were kind of in the dock, and they ended up getting acquitted, which was quite surprising. But
accidents, you know, will happen, they say.
Yeah, I think the most the kind of gut-wrenching thing for me whenever I read about this is that the kids' parents were on the set watching that happen. It's shocking, and it just tinges this movie. Unfortunately, the movie's not great anyway, but, you know, it was 58% on Rotten Tomatoes. It was a $10 million budget and a $29.4 million box office. And despite the $20 million profit that it made, I think we have to say that this movie had a cruel summer.
Yeah.
Just for the fact that, you know...
The stigmata against it, and rightly so. Yeah. I mean, Darren, do you... Did you know about this? I mean, it was publicized out back then. There was news reports and anything, but we didn't have the internet. We didn't have all the social media that we have now. Now, as it first came out, I didn't learn about this until probably in the early 2000s, you know, when YouTube started hitting and it said, you know, death on screen and everything like that. Twilight Zone, the movie, actor dies. I refuse to even, if it comes on, I don't know if I ever watched it since learning about it, but I do not own a DVD or Blu-ray of this movie.
No, I do own a digital version of it. And I didn't really, I knew there was an accident, I think, sort of during the late 80s, 90s. I didn't know to what extent. But I think when I watched the documentary and also the footage, there's plenty of footage on YouTube of the incident, and, you know, looking at that, and there's a morbid curiosity with it, but I knew that it wasn't particularly graphic or anything. It's kind of, you kind of piece it together in your head what's happened. It's horrific, it really is, and the documentary on Amazon kind of sets it all out and explains everything a lot better than we're doing, but it's just a really sad moment, and, you know, what could have been a great movie was just, you know, had this cloud over it, and I just think it affected everybody. It affected, you know, certainly, I mean, Spielberg changed his segment because tone of the story he was going to originally do would have been out of kilter with the timeout, you know, the Landis version. I still can't believe to this day that they put it out, you know, and the like I say, the section suffers from it. It does kind of just cut off, you know, it's not clear, you know, what happens towards the end. And it's just, this movie should have just been mothballed.
Yeah. That's my thought. You don't know whether it was going to be if there was going to be a redemption, you know, from Victor Morrow's character. He's just, you know, trotted off on the Jewish train, you know, for Nazi France, you know, Nazi occupied France, and taking off, seeing his buddies, you know, from when the bar he just left. I mean, it's kind of like, usually all the stories there, you know, had an ending, but you know, we're moving from one tragedy to maybe another tragedy. It's cinematic history. And that is, you know, July 22nd, Jaws 3D.
One aroused your fear like no movie before it. Then, just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water, two continued the legend. Now, for the first time, the terror of Jaws will not stop at the edge of the screen. The all-new Jaws 3D. The third dimension is terror, rated PG. Starts Friday at a theater near you.
How fucking dumb was
it? Let's get back to the fun now.
Was somebody taking a bath or washing their hands or taking a piss? You know?
This is a terrible film.
That fucking, and, you know, fin coming at you, then, I'm sorry, and then it turns out.
It's really weird. None of the TV spots that I could find had any footage, really, from the film in it. It's almost like they were so embarrassed about the quality of this film. And, you know, it was a reasonably... What was the budget now on the movie? Let me just look at this. So the budget was $20 million. Honestly, I think it must have gone in the kind of into the sort of 3D process of the movie. I never saw this in the cinema in 3D, and thank God I didn't, because I've seen it since on DVD in a 3D version, and it is just terrible. It started life as a comedy.
Yes, a spoof. It's going to be a spoof, like an airplane thing, supposedly.
Yeah, a National Lampoon's movie. They'd had a couple of bombs with the likes of Class Reunion and another title I can't remember the name of, and they wanted to get their hands on this, and it was going to be called Jaws 3 People Nil, directed by Joe Dante. And they actually went quite far into development with it until eventually they just kind of said, look, you know what, we've got a great idea for Jaws 3, which was to set it in fucking SeaWorld in Florida
with animal cruelty.
Yeah. I didn't watch this last week because I couldn't bring myself to do it, but am I right in thinking that they get a great white into captivity?
The offspring of the bigger one.
And so is it the bigger one that comes breaking in to try and get the little one? Right.
Yes, correct. Yep. You know, you got Leah Thompson, you know, in her first role. Everyone knows her as, Marty's mother from Back to the Future. You have an Oscar winner, Louis Gossett Jr. is in it, you know, and you have a coked up Dennis Quaid. Because the whole thing was that he was on fucking drugs the whole fucking movie. And is that's why, right? That's the only reason why he had to, in order to get through this, disaster and this claymation and this stop motion was...
this cardboard.
Yeah, it was to do fucking coke. Excuse me,
dear. Dreadful film.
Remember what they said.
They're forever poking things in your face in this. There's all sorts of things kind of being poked in your face and floating up to camera. There's the bit where it kind of breaks into the SeaWorld control room. And it is like somebody's got a cardboard cut out of a shark that they're moving closer to the camera. It's just dreadful.
And then people are like, is that a fucking shark coming towards me? How about you get the fuck out? Because he can't.
Pointing at it. Yeah.
It reminds me of Monty Python, The Holy Grail, where John Cleese is coming in at the castle the night, and it just repeats the same running gag over and over. And everyone's just like, what the hell is that? And then all of a sudden, aha! And he fucking kills him. But there's that also part where they make the shark explode, and that fucking E.T. doll comes out, as a kind of like a spoof to Spielberg. Have you ever noticed
is that at the end?
Yeah, there's an E.T. plush doll that comes out of the shark when it explodes. But it's a horrible movie. It's just, when you played that trailer that said the third dimension, I was like, are we going to fucking space? It's like...
But it was directed by Joe Alves, who did... he was the second unit guy on Jaws 2. He was also the production designer on the original Jaws. Mm-hmm. The guy was just doing a job. He's been hired to do a job, and this is... they wanted it to be 3D. I don't think they had any concept of the fact that in years to come, that 3D film in 2D is just going to look dreadful, which it does. And so they hired this guy, and the poor guy won a Golden Raspberry for it, for worst director. And he hasn't worked since as a director. I just think, that's a bit cruel, is that? But it's, like I say, laughable 3D effects work. Absolutely null of any tension throughout. A bunch of characters you really could not give a shit about. Roy Scheider, he smelled a rat. Way, way before this went into production. And he's quoted as saying there was no way on earth, even though he was contracted to Universal, he was saying there was no way on earth he was going to do that movie. And so he signed up for, what was the film there? Oh, Blue Thunder with Columbia Pictures, which, although it didn't make as much money as Jaws 3.
It's a better film.
It's a much better film. Yeah. So Jaws 3... 20.5 million budget, 88 million at the box office, 88 million pounds worth of robbery.
But it's because it's based on name only, cash grab of the name. Yeah. That fucking Finn coming at you.
And 12% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, rightly. Was rightly 12%.
Yeah, that's too generous. But it's dreadful. It really is a fucking shocking movie. But thankfully, on July 29, we were saved by this.
This summer, when you think vacation, think National Lampoon's Vacation. See the real America.
Hey, underpants. Hey, yellow.
It's friendly.
I'm okay.
Don't you want to look at the Grand Canyon?
It's educational.
Great.
And most of all, it's fun.
The dog went on the picnic basket.
Let Chevy Chase, Beverly D'Angelo, Imogene Coca, Randy Quaid, John Candy, and Christie Brinkley.
Well, are you going to go for it?
This is crazy. This is crazy. This is crazy.
Take you for a ride. This summer, when you think vacation, think National Lampoon's Vacation.
Better check under the hood.
What a great movie. What a but you're showing the trailer there. I don't think John Candy ever yelled that high in his life. But yeah, this is probably National Lampoon's best movie of all time that they put out. And Beverly D'Angelo was beautiful in that movie. Yeah. Even so beautiful that Anthony Michael Hall tried to peek in on her, in that shower scene, because he was all horned up, he snuck in and took a look at her, that was his first shot of live breasts in his life. The horned dog you are, Michael. Do you remember seeing this movie and just laughing out loud?
So I saw European Vacation first, and for me, European Vacation is my favorite of the two. I love them both.
Hit home.
European Vacation. Yeah, it did. It did. Mr. Greaseball.
I'll take the bumper back to New York. Because that's where everyone comes from in the United States, right? They come from
Yeah. No, I think I enjoyed European Vacation more than I enjoyed Vacation. In fact, I like all of them. Even Vegas, there's a few choice moments in that.
Yeah, yeah, a few chuckles.
But I know what you mean. Harold Ramis directing, Chevy Chase, Beverly D'Angelo, Randy Quaid, John Candy, Anthony Michael Hall, Dana Barron, and Christy Brinkley.
She still looks beautiful today, to this day.
Yeah,
I just remember, a Dinky, the dog, pissing on the basket, and they're eating the sandwiches, and Edna's just doesn't give a shit, and she's eating.
Didn't he leave the dog tied to the car or something?
Yeah, tied to the boots bumper. And that actually did happen. They were filming it, and somebody saw a dog tied to a bumper from one of the crew. And they're just like, whoa, 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 hold on, your dog's still tied to the fucking bumper. And they're oh shit, we totally forgot. They added that into the script later because of that. But of course, that other dog had a happy ending. This Dinky didn't. But, Dinky's a piece of shit, always going after Clark. And he watches Family Feud. I think it's a summer classic. I think it's when you watch this, it's the start of the summer.
No, I agree. I think, it's one of those films that's just you never get bored of watching. It was nice that it was an R-rated comedy as well at a time where there weren't as many, it's not hugely R-rated, but just enough to make a family comedy that little bit more edgier, because ultimately I still think it is a family comedy.
Yeah.
And based on a John Hughes short story called Vacation 58, which was published in National Lampoon's magazine. And he was a little pissed, wasn't he? Because Harold Ramis and Chevy Chase totally rewrote his story, which was done through the eyes of a kind of small kid experiencing a kind of, a family holiday back in 1958. And, it was a comedy. Sweet and fun. They didn't particularly, because Chevy Chase was on a kind of high at that moment in time.
Yep. Saturday Night Live and everything,
They decided to rewrite it all through the sort of perspective of Chevy Chase, Clark Griswold. And I think John Hughes kind of wasn't particularly happy about that. But yeah,
but it all came out for the better.
yeah. I mean, a great result at the box office with $61.3 million. $15 million budget. It's quite expensive for a comedy. 93% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Pretty good for a comedy. Yeah. Most comedies don't get that. I think Airplane was the last comedy that we saw that was actually that high. And it also knocked off, Jaws 3D and Return of the Jedi off top of the box office.
Yeah.
For that week. Not in all time, but it was during that whole month and that week. It became number one at the box office, and rightly so. Especially with Beverly in the shower. It should have been that way.
But, you know, and this is one of the reasons why, you know, talking about Jaws 3D and the likes of Superman 3 and Return of the Jedi, that's why I've kind of subtitled this episode The Downfall, because there were three franchises there that kind of hit a low, if you, I guess. You know, Return of the Jedi was probably the weakest of the trilogy, although it didn't kill off Star Wars. No. It certainly was the weakest of the trilogy. Superman 3 was the beginning of the end for that, and Jaws 3D, as we mentioned, the beginning of this, certainly the, well, almost the end for that. You know, you wouldn't imagine you could make a worse film than Jaws 3D in terms of the, you know, that franchise, but my God, they managed it a few years' time. But August the 5th, I think it was last week, we had Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which was a kind of, you know, milestone teen comedy. This is more of a milestone sort of teen drama, a movie called Risky Business with Tom Cruise. Take those old records
off the shelf. I don't remember giving permission for a party, Joe.
A party? I've been living to
them by myself. You ever get high, Joe? This music ain't
got the same soul. I'll never do anything stupid.
Please stop.
There's a time for playing it safe and a time for risky business. Starring Tom Cruise, rated R.
Starts Friday at a theater near you. Check your newspaper for local listings.
So, Frank, Risky Business.
Risky Business is one of those movies that you didn't feel starting at the beginning you were going to like until you see how much nudity is in it.
I agree. I was saying to my wife the other day, she was out and I watched Risky Business. I hadn't seen it for quite a few years. And I actually closed my blinds in the lounge because there was
so did I was watching this downstairs and I could see my neighbor with a garden hose just
Rebecca and, you know, DeMornay.
Oh, full frontal.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, gorgeous in this, is especially when he because it deals with a movie with a kid trying to get into college. You know, and he has a project being done for his entrepreneur class that, you know, he has to come up with an idea, create a business, create a whole, like just any business, a whole input, output, product, everything like that, and try to make it, you know, profitable. And so they made this thing called like a fucking memo reminder, or if you have to remember something, you write down a piece of paper, you hit the slit, hit the switch, and it gets off this red fucking button and this noise. Well, now that the Tom Cruise's parents are away, all of his friends, including the guy who plays Booger from Nerds, is in it, and Malky from Perfect Strangers, you know, he's in it. Now that your parents are away, let's go have some fun. They have a few parties here and there, and you know what? Let's go get a girl. So they wind up getting a transvestite, you know, the first time. It's like, it's this big black guy who was like, I'm here, honey. You know, he's like, listen, you don't open this fucking door. I'm going to open it. The guy's very cordial. He's like, listen, here's $40. You know, he gives him $40 for his time for coming out, gives him money for cafe, which is the honorable thing to do. You wasted this poor guy's time. And he's like, listen, here's a phone number. There's a girl. Oh, yeah, she'll be into you. Don't worry, and you'll be into her. And you get this, and Tom Cruise gets Rebecca De Mora in. You know, he's like, "Are you?" She says, "Are you ready for me?" And this song from the band, was it Tangerine Cream? You know, comes
Tangerine
on.
Dream.
Oh, Tangerine Cream. That's what he was doing Tangerine. At the time. Tangerine. He was creaming during this one part, but yeah, Tangerine Dream comes in. You know, he comes up behind her. He lifts up her skirt. She's completely nude underneath it. But you almost think it was a dream sequence because the door opens up. The leaves and
the wind blow in.
You know, and you wind up seeing that they're fucking on every place in this house. Staircases, chairs, you know, right there up front. And she decides to stay because she likes it there. And he begins his kind of entrepreneurship as a pimp. His business is being in a pimp as a pimp, but it's a movie. Oh, Darren, I'm sure you loved it.
No, I did, but I was just the only thing I can think of when that sequence happens and the door blows open. If that was me, I'd be like, "Oh shit! Hang on a minute! All the fucking leaves are blowing in." One second,
get the broom out. You know, start.
Just, I would. I'd be
right with you.
Whole mess. I think a couple of things that I picked up on when I was looking into this was Tom Cruise had to, because he was like 21 at the time, wasn't he? And he had to pass for like a 15, 16 year old. And so he had to lose loads of weight. They made him lose loads of weight and then eat loads of fatty foods to put like a load of puppy fat on in order to look like a kind of teenager. Usual thing again with the sort of famous faces that were up for this role: John Cusack, Nick Cage, Michael J. Fox, Tom Hanks, Sean Penn, all auditioned. Rob Lowe turned it down because he thought the film was weird. What a mistake that was. Also, I noticed that the great Serge from Beverly Hills Cop is in there as well.
that's Malky from whatever that I just said, you know, Perfect Strangers.
Perfect Strangers. Yeah. And the one thing that I picked up on, and we've mentioned this guy quite a few times now, was that Brian Backer, the pervert from The Burning, and also he was in Fast Times at Ridgemont High as well, was cast as Joel. And then at the last minute, Tom Cruise accepted the job and he had to step down. Can you imagine what this movie would have been like with that kind of creepy little guy from The Burning in it?
But Tom Cruise did have that Boy Next Door look, didn't he?
Hmm.
And
it not the probably perv from The Burning look.
No. Eddie had one of the most iconic shots probably in cinematic history that everyone tries to copy is dancing to, Bob Seger.
Yeah. Sliding along the floor there.
Yeah, and I tried doing it myself and fucking hitting my head on the floor. And I don't think any man wears tidy whities, as they call them. You know, I think most men wear boxer briefs or something like that, you know, or boxers.
Just the thought of you sliding along the floor there.
And then screaming on my way down.
You're doing it to like Napalm Death or Guar or something like that.
Yeah, the Tangerine Cream. I'm playing Metallica's, you know, Fade to Black, you know, or something like that. To Guar. Yeah. Twisted Sister, you know.
Wow, they had an album out, the Guar, that just made me like feel ill every time I heard the title or saw the cover. It was called Phallus in Wonderland.
Well, this movie is sort of like that, right? Because
I guess so.
Well, by the end of the movie, or towards the middle of the movie, Rebecca's pimp shows up, or her handler.
Yeah.
And says, you know, Joel, hey, you know, you can't be taking my girls like this. You're going to have to, you know, pay me back, you know, something that, you know, my time, you know, for what they've done. And then what does he do? He starts taking everything in the fucking house.
Yeah. He's got a barter with him, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Give me this.
So basically Joel comes up with the idea, you know what, I'll buy everything back. So he didn't even turn a profit. You know, because he was going to take all the money that the girls made for him for staying at, you know, his house. And the girls felt safe and everything. And basically at the end of the movie, he has nothing. He basically, the stuff he made, he had to give back over in order to save, you know, his family's house. And especially, what was it, that vase or something that was on the...
He has a broken egg. She reckons there's a crack in it or something like that. But
and she's very disappointed in him.
It's a decent film. It's good.
Yes.
And it really, you know, catapulted Tom Cruise, who'd already done, I think, all the right moves at that point, at the end, Taps.
But wasn't a Scientologist yet.
No, he wasn't, no. But yeah, Risky Business was a $6.2 million budget, 92% on Rotten Tomatoes. A lot of high 90s films this week.
Yeah.
And $63 million at the box office in 1983. That's,
I think it had to do with Rebecca being that with the $63 million.
Oh, sure, yeah. Before we go on, we have a few honorable mentions. May 13 saw the release of Blue Thunder, Roy Scheider. At $22 million budget. It was an expensive movie. Roy Scheider playing a helicopter pilot for the police, I think, if I'm right. Yeah, I've seen it once ages ago. 78% on Rotten Tomatoes and $42 million at the box office. So cool, kind of.
Yeah.
Class, which I really like Class. I don't know if you've seen it. The Andrew McCarthy, Rob Lowe, the two kids at college or university, mm-hmm. and one of them has an affair with her. He goes out one night, he has an affair with an older woman, and it turns out that it's his roommate's mom. And I really enjoyed that film. But it's just got such poor rating on Rotten Tomatoes, 29%.
It's a maybe fantasy of most young boys.
Maybe that's why I watched it.
Your mom's looking actually kind of hot.
Was it Jacqueline Bisset? I think it was.
I think it was, yes. She's definitely easy on the eyes. She's not trailer park trash.
So that was July 22. On the same day, Mr. Mom came out. Michael Keaton.
Another hot mom.
Yeah. Who was the Terry Garr, was it, I think?
Yeah.
Mr. Mom was a big hit. $5 million budget, $64.7 million box office, so huge return for them. 78% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Love Mr. Mom. And funny movie.
Yeah, it's a really funny movie. Perhaps we should have talked about that a little bit more rather than, War Games or Octopussy or something.
Well, when we get to our, gender role movies, we'll switch it up.
Yeah. And then finally, the last honourable mention is July the 29th, a film that I'm quite fond of. Huge budget, $47 million was spent on the disaster that was Krull. It only made $17 million at the box office and a Rotten Tomatoes score of 32%. A terribly cruel, cruel summer. Another one of these sci-fi movies that was kind of still trying to be on the off the back of, I guess, Star Wars or even Flash Gordon. I think it's more similar to Flash Gordon than Star Wars. But
people are just getting tired of it.
Yeah, yeah. Great score. Really good score for that film. But a terrible summer for it, which leaves us with our last movie. And, our last movie, I think, is one of these films that should deserve to do better, because I think the performances in this film are terrific. And that's August the 12th, and it's Stephen King's Cujo.
Cujo?
From the novel by Stephen King, creator of Carrie and The Shining, comes a chilling new tale.
Cujo.
Now, there's a new name for terror. Cujo, directed by Louis Teague. Rated R. Now playing. Check newspapers for a theater near you.
One of our friend, Jason Nikes, his one of his favorite movies of all time. And he said it a couple times. For me, Cujo is one of those movies that is terrifying, because I know about the breed it's based on. The Saint Bernard is not they're not really known to be a aggressive breed. They're this happy-go-lucky breed that loves everybody so much that they had several of these dogs playing Cujo, that they were so happy to be on set around people they had to tie their tails down because they were always wagging all the time. You can't have a happy rabid dog. the dog trainer, very famous dog trainer, Carl Miller, he said, we can't train Bernards that well because they're not really up to training. They're more, living with loving people and helping people. That's their breed. So he suggested Dobermans, which would have made everything, seem more, more dark. But he would later on to go do, a movie called Zoltan, which you and I think is a fantastic.
The Hound of Dracula.
The Hound of Dracula. This dog with these other fangs, sucking on puppies, they're turning him into vampire puppies. But yeah, what did you think of it? I don't watch Cujo a lot. Actually, I've only maybe watched it twice in life, just because, you know, people know I'm an animal lover. It doesn't represent, you know, that breed that well, but maybe that's what Stephen King and also the director tried to do. And as you know, with most Stephen King stories, the movies don't represent what was actually written in the books.
Yeah. Yeah, and it, I think originally in the book, I think the book, the dog is possessed by the spirit of a serial killer.
Yeah.
Which kind of sounds a little bit like Christine or even Child's Play or something like that. Mm-hmm. Also, what's really funny about this is that Stephen King wrote this at the kind of height of his addiction problems and has no recollection of writing it whatsoever. Can you imagine that? And I know I've heard things like this before, whereas, you know, I know Alice Cooper went through a period of recording some of his albums. He just can't remember, you know, I think
it's probably too. Around that. He can't sing some of his songs.
Yeah. Flush to Fashion and Special Forces that he kind of has really no recollection of recording. But, you know, I personally, I think this film is... deserves a hell of a lot more credit. I think that some of the dog attacks are terrifying. Mm-hmm. And then when you see what they... You say that there was, 13 different dogs or something that they used
several.
For this?
Several.
There were also people in dog costumes. And you cannot tell, you cannot spot in the film at all when mm-hmm. there's a person in a dog costume at all. I've seen quite a few on-set photos of the St. Bernard, you call them St. Bernard, St. Bernard dog outfits that just look like some sort of taxidermy thing. They look so real. I kind of, when you watch this movie, I kind of feel for the dogs a little bit because they're kind of caked in all this kind of goo and slime and,
fake,
you know,
blood,
the stuff
and everything.
Around
its
fake blood and the kind of slime coming from its eyes and its nose and that, because obviously it's kind of badly infected. But the dogs must have been fantastic on set. But nobody tops the kid's performance. Tad. Danny Pintauro, I think?
Yeah.
Him and Dee Wallace do an absolutely stellar job with this movie. And that kid, it's one of the best child performances I've ever seen. When he's going through all those stages of having a fit and passing out, and you know, it's a
and
really
Dee Wallace losing
move.
Yeah, and Dee Wallace losing her mind and saying, "I'll get your daddy," because she's just so frustrated.
Yeah,
and Jason
yeah.
talks about that plenty of times. He said that's as a parent, you do lose frustration when your kid just keeps on, you know, screaming and yelling. You have no choice but to just lash out, not at your kid, you know, or hit him or anything, but just like scream and be like, "I'll fucking get it," you know, just to fucking end it. And do you know, it seemed like it was supposed to be hot, you know, because everyone's sweating and everything. They filmed it during like fucking 30 degree weather. It was like 40 degrees outside. Dee Wallace and the young kid, you had to rely on the heater of the car.
Yeah. It looks sweltering. It's one of those movies that just looks so grimy and dirty and filthy all the time. It looks like it's searing heat. But it was filmed in the winter months in California, wasn't it? Yeah. And they were freezing all the time.
One thing we also have to look at, too, is with... remember at the end where Cujo's laying on top of her dead? That dog was actually sedated.
Really?
Yeah. Now, we also knew about... That's we also cool. know about this with Church from Pet Sematary.
Mm.
You know... They some of the cats there were sedated in order to get some of the effects. Nowadays, you can't do that. It's either, you know, the dog's asleep and he knows what to do on his own, you know, accord, or you don't have that shot. You will not do that at all. And most people now, you and I included, don't agree with something like that today.
No.
Dee Wallace was so scared because not only she's having this 100-pound plus dog, you know, on top of her for this one shot, but the dog started waking up. It started moving itself. And she was afraid that the first thing he saw was her and was going to attack her.
Yeah, it's not cool, is it? I don't like hearing stuff like that.
No.
It wouldn't happen today. Today, they'd just it'd be a CG dog like that bloody Harrison Ford film that came out.
For fuck's sake. Throughout the whole movie, too. Even dancing and juggling. Buddy.
Yeah. But that brings us to the end, I think. You know, Cujo, $5 million budget, $21.1 million at the box office, which I think I'm going to say it's cool. I'm going to say it's cool. It made four times what its budget was, and it is a great film. It deserves a lot better than the 63% on Rotten Tomatoes. And
it's
I
the animal
stand,
lovers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I stand with you and Jason in saying that it's a really, really good horror film.
It's a classic. It's a Stephen King classic. It's a it's a movie when people say name, you know, three Stephen King movies or, you know, books. They're going to say, what are they going to say? It, Carrie, Cujo.
Yeah.
Probably those are his top.
Shining.
So let's not go into The Shining. That's good. We're going to be here forever talking about that. All right.
Okay, so next week, or 2 weeks' time, sorry. We may fit a bonus episode in next week, but in 2 weeks' time, we've got 1984, and we've got Dave McRae back with us. So that will be fun. Hopefully, we haven't picked the titles that we're going to look at yet. It's almost surely going to be the likes of Temple of Doom, Karate Kid, Ghostbusters. It's a massive year and really makes up for the kind of the real lack of quality movies that came out in 1983. But, you know, I think it's going to be fun. It's going to be fun. And we hopefully we're going to have a special guest on in 1987. Barry from Wolfman's Got Nards is going to join us for 1987. So that should be fun.
I wonder what movie we'll be discussing during 1987.
That's why we wanted him on. We wanted his take on it.
It's like having Dave on to talk about Indiana Jones.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
We go to the experts, you know, the people who know it better than Darren and I do.
Also, if you could drop comments below. We'd like to hear from everybody. So,
absolutely.
Like I say, we've had, so far, I can't remember the exact number, but it is thousands of downloads on the podcast. And also the YouTube channel is kind of getting some traction as well now. We're going to do our first live podcast, live stream tonight after we finish recording this. Let's hear from you. If you've got any questions, any comments, any feedback, let us know. I think the one bit of feedback that I'd like to know is, should Frank tidy those wires up behind us over there? Let us know in the comments below.
When I get to it. But you know what? On that note, stick to the roads.
And the best of luck.
See you later.
Bye.